Stand not the crowd's applause. I make and hear and earn again. For I am the crowd and I am the ball. I am the triumph and the blame. I am the turf, the pies, the all. Always and ever I am the game. It matters not who won or lost. Nothing is the score you made. Fame is a petal that curls in the frost. But I will remember how you played. And it stays there, Glenda thought, like sound in a banner. Everybody one part of it. Juliet and Trev began to float down, hand in hand, turning gently until they landed lightly on the turf, still kissing. A sort of reality began to leak back into the arena, and there are some people who, even when hearing the voice of the nightingale, will say, "What's that bloody noise?" "Cheating bastard!" said Andy, and launched himself directly at Trev, covering the ground at speed as the boy stood there with a very bemused but happy expression on his face. He did not notice the hell-bent Andy until a huge boot kicked him squarely in the groin, so hard that the eyes of all male watchers watered in sympathetic pain. For the second time in 24 hours, Trev felt the micromale sing as the thousands of links moved and just as quickly settled down again. It was as if a little breeze had blown up his pants. Apart from that, he hadn't felt a thing. Andy, on the other hand, had. He was lying on the ground, bent double, making a sort of whistling noise through his teeth. Someone slapped Trev on the back. It was Pepe.
"You did put my pants on, didn't you? Well, obviously not my pants. You'd have to be suicidal to want to put my pants on. Anyway, I've come up with a name for the stuff. I'm going to call it Retributium. Can't ever say it will be an end to war, because I can't imagine anything putting an end to war. But it sends the force back the way it came. Didn't chafe either, did it?"
"No," said Trev, amazed.
"Well, it did for him. My word, though, he's a game one. That reminds me, I'll need a picture of you in them."
Andy was rising slowly, elevating himself to the vertical almost by willpower alone. Pepe grinned, and somehow it seemed obvious to Trev that anyone who was going to get up and try any threats with Pepe grinning at him was more than suicidal.
"Got a knife, have you, you little squirt?" said Andy.
"No, Andy," said Nut behind him. "No more. The game is over. Fortune has favoured unseen academicals, and I believe the traditional ending is to exchange shirts in an atmosphere of good fellowship."
"But not pants," said Pepe under his breath. "What do you know about that sort of thing?" growled Andy. "You're a bloody orc. I know all about you people. You can tear arms and legs off. You're black magic. I'm not scared of you."
He came at Nut with commendable speed for a man in such pain. Nut dodged.
"I believe there is a peaceful solution to the obvious enmity between us."
"You what?"
Pepe and some of the footballers were closing in. Andy had not been making friends. Nut waved them away.
"I'm sure I could help you, Andy. Yes, you are right. I am an orc. But doesn't an orc have eyes? Doesn't an orc have ears? Doesn't an orc have arms and legs?"
"Yeah, at the moment," said Andy, and leaped.
What happened next happened so fast that Trev didn't see the middle of it. It started with Andy jumping, and finished with him sitting on the ground with Nut's hands clamped around his head, claws out.
"Let me see now," Nut mused as the man struggled in vain. "Twisting the skull with enough force to snap the spine and spinal column should not present much difficulty, since it is a non-rotating joint. And, of course, the ear holes and eye sockets allow for extra grip in the manner of a bowling ball," he added happily.
There was a horrified hush as he continued. "Using the unit of measurement of force invented by Sir Rosewood Bunn, I should think that a mere 250 buns should do the trick. But of course, and possibly surprisingly, it is the tearing of the skin, tendons and muscles that would present me with some difficulty. You are a young man, and the tensile strength would be quite high. I imagine the skin alone would require a force of about 1,000 buns.
Andy yelped as his head was gently twisted.
"Oh, I say, look here now," said Ridcully. "A joke is a joke and all that, but..."
"From then on, it gets rather messy," said Nut. "Muscle would tear off the bones comparatively easily."
Andy gave another strangled yelp.
"But, taking it all in all, I would think a force of between 3 to 5 kilobuns should do the trick."
He paused. "Just my little joke, Andy. I know you like a laugh. I would also, I believe, be quite capable of putting one hand down your throat and pulling out your stomach."
"Go ahead,"
croaked Andy. And around the arena of the hippo, the beast smelled blood. After all, it wasn't just horse racing that had taken place in the hippo over the centuries. The comparatively small amount of blood that had been shed today was nothing compared with the oceans of the centuries gone by. But the beast knew blood when it smelled it. The cheering and the chanting now picked up, and the words grew louder and louder as people rose to their feet. Orc, orc, orc. Nut stood impassively and then turned to the former dean. Could I please ask everyone else to leave? This may become messy.
Oh, come on, said Trev. No way.
Ah, well, said Nut. Maybe just the ladies.
Not likely, said Glenda.
In that case, would you please be so kind as to lend me your megaphone, referee? And I would be grateful if you would instruct some of the stronger players on the field to restrain Mr. Shank, who is, I believe, sadly not in his right mind.
Wordlessly, it was handed over. Nut took it as the storm of orc, orc grew louder, walked a little way from the rest of the group, and stood there impassively with his arms folded until the taunting stopped out of sheer lack of momentum. With every eye watching him, he raised the megaphone to his lips and said,
"Gentlemen, yes, indeed, I am an orc and will always be one. And may I say that it's been a privilege to play here today and to see you all. But I do gather now that being an orc in this city may be seen as something of a problem to some of you." He paused. "So I would ask you to excuse me if I request that this matter be sorted out between us now."
There was laughter and some jeers from various parts of the ground, but also, it seemed to Glenda, the beast was calling upon itself for silence. In that pin-drop silence, the thud of the megaphone hitting the ground could be heard in every corner. Then Nut rolled up his sleeves and lowered his voice so that people had to strain to listen. He said,
"Come on, if you think you're hard enough."
First there was shock, and then the silence of disbelief and the whisper of every head turning to every other head and saying, "Did he really say that?" And then someone high in the stands started to clap, at first slowly, and then at an accelerating tempo as it reached the crowd's tipping point, when not clapping would be unthinkable. Ceasing to clap was also unthinkable, and within a minute the applause was a storm. Nut turned back to the rest of the team with tears streaming down his face.
"Do I have worth?" he said to Glenda.
She ran towards him and hugged him.
"You always did. Then, when the match is over, there are things we have to do."
"But it's been over for ages," said Glenda.
"No, it's not over until the referee blows his whistle. Everyone knows that."
"By Io, he's right," said Ridcully. "Go on, Dean, give it the works."
The Arch-Chancellor of Brazeneck University felt gracious enough to let that one pass. He put the gigantic whistle to his lips, filled his lungs with air, and sent the pea rattling. Despite everything, the shade of Evans the Striped had the last word.
"No boy is to fiddle about in the showers!"
As the crowd streamed down from the stands, trampling the now sacred turf, Ridcully tapped a gloomy Mr. Hoggett on the shoulder and said,
"It would be my privilege to change shirts with you, sir."
He dropped his hat on the ground, pulled off his shirt and revealed a chest so hairy that it looked like two sleeping lions. The United shirt he received in return was somewhat of a tight fit, but that was unimportant because, as Andy had predicted, the unseen academicals were indeed picked up by the yelling crowd, except for Mrs. Whitlow, who fought back, and carried in glory through the city. It was a triumph. Whether you won or lost, it was still a triumph. It is traditional on these occasions for the conquering heroes to spray bottles of champagne on the crowd. This did not happen. If a wizard succeeds in getting the cork out of a champagne bottle, he certainly does not intend to pour it away.
"You think it's all over?"
The wizards of Unseen University knew how to party. Pepe and Madame Sharn, who was the same shape as most of the wizards and felt doubly at home, were impressed. However, business was business, and they had to think about Juliet.
"I can't see her anywhere," said Madame.
"I think I saw two of her a while ago," said Pepe. "These fellows do themselves well. I have never seen such a large cheese board. It almost makes celibacy seem worthwhile."
"Oh, do you think so?"
"No. By the way, have you noticed that very tall wizard giving you the eye, my dear?"
"That's Professor Bengo Macarona. Do you think he..."
Madame began.
"Without a shadow of a doubt, my dear. I know he's hurt his legs, but I doubt if that would be a problem."
Once again, Madame craned to search the crowd for the glittering figure.
"I do hope our young model is not getting involved in any hanky-panky."
"How could she? She's totally surrounded by admirers."
"It's still possible."
In fact, Juliet and Trev were sitting in the darkness of the night kitchen.
"I'll find something to do," said Trev. "I'll go wherever you go."
"You ought to stay here and play football," said Juliet. "You know what some people said when we were drinking? They said Dave Likely was your father."
"Well, yeah, that's true."
"Yes," said Juliet, "but they used to say you were his son."
"Well, maybe a bit of football," Trev conceded, "but I don't think I'll get away with a tin can again." They kissed. There and then, that was all that appeared necessary. However, Glenda and Nut had also wanted to find a place a little out of the way, and, if possible, dark. Fortuitously, she had pulled out of her pocket a pair of tickets, placed there by Dr. Hicks in his attempt to spread darkness and despondency throughout the world by the means of amateur dramatics, to the Dolly Sisters Players production of Star Crossed by Huell the playwright. They sat hand in hand, watching it solemnly, feeling the ripples move them, then discussed it as they walked back through the city, carefully skirting the chanting bands of happy, drunken supporters.
"What did you think?" said Nut, after a while. "About the play, I mean."
"I don't see that it was that romantic," said Glenda. "To be honest, I thought it was a bit silly."
"It is widely regarded as one of the great romantic plays of the last 50 years, said Nut.
"Really? But what type of example are they setting? First of all, didn't anyone in Genoa, even in those days, know how to take a pulse? Is a little first-aid knowledge too much to expect? Even a hand mirror would have helped. There are quite a number of respectable places where you can take a pulse."
"I think that's because neither of them were thinking about themselves, perhaps," said Nut.
"Neither of them was thinking at all," said Glenda. "And they certainly weren't thinking about each other as people. A little common sense and they would be alive. It's made up, like books. I don't think anyone sensible would act like that."
He squeezed her hand. "Sometimes you speak like Ladyship," he said. "And that reminds me."
"Reminds you of what?"
"It's time for me to meet my maker."
Andy Shank walked unsteadily among the night's time alleys, secure in the knowledge that they contained nothing worse than him, a belief which, as it happened, was in error.
"Mr. Shank."
"Who's asking?" he said, turning around and reaching instinctively into his coat for his new cutlass.
But another knife, silver and thin, sliced twice, and a foot expertly stamped the length of his shin and forced him to the ground.
"Me. I'm the happy ending. You can call me the good fairy. Don't worry, you'll be able to see by the time you wipe the blood out of your eyes, and, as they say, now you won't have to pay for a drink in any bar in this town, though I suspect you never have."
His attacker leaned nonchalantly against the wall.
"And the reason I'm doing this, Mr. Shank, is that I am a bastard. I am an old bugger. I am a sod. They let you get away with it because they were nice people. And, you know, the world needs someone like me to set the balance square. Since before you were born, I have known people like you. Tormentors, bullies and thieves. Ah, yes, thieves. Thieves of other people's self-respect. Thieves of their peace of mind. Now, Mr. Nut, he's an orc, and I've heard that he can talk people better. Well, so be it, say I. If it works, he's a genius, but that don't square things, not in my book. So I thought you ought to meet Pepe, just to say hello. If I ever see you again, they'll never find all the pieces. But just to show that I have a decent streak, here's something to put on your wounds."
Something landed softly near Andy's groping hand. Andy, dripping blood and snot onto the pavement, reached around quickly as the trim little footsteps disappeared, thinking only of getting the blood out of his eyes and revenge and retribution out of his heart. And, in the circumstances, therefore, he should not have wiped the half-lemon across his face.
"You think it's all over?"
It is a regrettable fact that when two people are dining at a very large and impressive dining table, they sit at the opposite ends of the long axis. This is incredibly stupid and makes conversation difficult and the passing of food impossible. But even Lord Veterinari and Lady Margolotta had apparently signed up to the idea. On the other hand, they both ate very little, and so there wasn't very much to pass.
"'Your secretary seems to be getting on very well with my librarian,' said Lady Margarita.
"'Yes,' observed Vetinari. "'Apparently they are comparing ring-binders. "'He has invented a new one.'
"'Well, for the proper working of the world,' said Lady Margarita, "'it is essential that ring-binders are important to at least one person.'
She put down her glass and looked towards the door.
"'You seem nervous,' said Vetinari. "'Are you wondering how he will come?'
"'He has had a very long day, and a remarkably successful one.
"'And you say he's gone to an amateur dramatics performance?'
"'Yes, with that very forthright young lady who makes the pies,' said Vetinari.
"'I see,' said Lady Margarita. "'He must know I am here, and he's gone off with a cook.'
There was just a trace of a smile on Vetinari's lips. Not any cook, a genius amongst cooks.
"'Well, I must admit to being surprised,' said her ladyship.
"'And upset,' said Vetinari. "'A little jealous, perhaps?'
"'Havelock, you go too far. Would you expect otherwise? Besides, you must surely realise that his triumph is yours, too.
"'Did I tell you that I've seen some of them?' said Margarita after a while.
"'The orcs?'
"'Yes, they really are wretched. Of course, people say that about the goblins, and while it is true that they religiously save their own snot, and frankly, just about everything else, at least there is a logic to it.'
"'Well, a religious logic, at least,' murmured Vetinari. "'They tend to be quite stretchable. The Igors made them from men, did you know?'
Vetinari, still holding his glass, walked to the other end of the table and picked up the pepper-pot.
"'No. However, now you tell me it's patently obvious. Goblins would not have been nearly ferocious enough.'
"'And they had nothing,' said Margarita. "'No culture, no legends, no history. He could give them those.'
"'Everything they are not, he is,' said Vetinari, adding, "'But that's an enormous weight you're putting on his shoulders.'
"'How much is on mine? How much of a weight is on yours?'
"'It's rather like being a cart-horse,' said Vetinari. "'After a while one ceases to notice. It's just the way of life. "'They deserve their chance, and it must be taken now while the world is at peace.'
"'Peace?' said Vetinari.
"'Ah, yes, defined as a period of time to allow for preparation for the next war. "'Where did you learn such cynicism, Havelock?'
Vetinari spun around and began his absent-minded walk along the length of the table again.
"'Well, mostly from you, madam, though I have to say that the credit is not all yours, since I have had an extended period of further education as tyrant of this city. I think you allow them too much freedom.
Oh, yes, I do. That's why I am still tyrant of this city. The way to retain power, I have always thought, is to ensure the absolute unthinkability of oneself not being there. I shall help you in any way I can, of course. There should be no slaves, even slaves to instinct.
One person can make a difference, said Margarita. Look at Mr. Shine, who is now Diamond King of Trolls. Look at yourself. If men can fall.
Vetinari gave a sharp laugh.
Oh, they can indeed. "'Then orcs can rise,' said Margarita. "'If that is not true, then the universe is not true.'
There was a velvet-like knock at the double doors, and Drumknot entered.
"'And Mr. Nutt is here, sir,' he added with a certain disdain, "'and he's with that woman who cooks in the university.'
Vetinari glanced at Margarita.
"'Yes,' he said. "'I think we should see him in the main hall.'
Drumknot coughed.
"'I think I should tell you, sir, that Mr. Nutt acquired entrance to the building through gates that were securely locked.'
"'Did he tear them off their hinges?'
asked Vetinari, with apparent enthusiastic interest.
"'No, sir. He lifted the gates bodily off their hinges and stacked them neatly against the wall.
Ah, then there is still hope for the world.
And the guards?'
Drumknot glanced for a moment at Lady Margarita.
"'I have taken the precaution of stationing some of them inconspicuously in the Great Hall Gallery with crossbows.'
"'Stand them down,' said Vetinari.
"'Stand them down,' said Margarita.
"'Stand them down,' said Vetinari again, directly to Drumknot.
He extended his arm to her ladyship.
"'I think the term is, as they put it, alia iacta est. The die, your ladyship, is cast, and we should both see how it falls.'
"'Will you get into trouble for that?' said Glenda, staying close to Nutt as they walked up the steps. The main hall of the palace was an intimidating place when empty, because it had been designed for exactly that purpose.
Why didn't you just knock like everyone else?
My dear Glenda, I am not like anyone else, and neither are you.
Then what are you going to do?
I don't know. What will Ladyship do? I have no idea, although I am becoming aware of how she thinks, and there are a few possibilities I have in mind.
They watched two figures coming down the broad staircase that extended up into the rest of the building. It had been built to accommodate hundreds. The two people coming down looked uncharacteristically small.
"Ah, Mr. Nutt," said Vetinari, as they had almost reached the bottom step. "And Miss Sugarbean. I must add my congratulations to the pair of you on the wonderful, albeit surprising, success of Unseen Academicals.
I think you are going to have to make a lot of changes to the rules, sir," said Nutt.
"Such as?" said Vetinari.
"I think you need assistance for the referee. His eyes can't be everywhere," said Nutt. "And there do need to be some more rules, although Mr. Hoggett did the honourable thing, I think.
And Professor Rincewind might make a very capable attacker if only you could persuade him to take the ball with him," said Vetinari.
"I would never tell the Arch-Chancellor this, my lord, but I think he may be better in a more defensive role."
"Who would you suggest as an alternative?" said Vetinari.
"Well, Charlie, the animated skeleton who works in the Department of Post-Mortem Communications, did very well in trials. And after all," he paused for a moment, "yes, after all, none of us can help how we're made."
They turned at a tap, tap, tapping behind them. It was Lady Margolotta's foot.
Nutt gave a little bow. "Ladyship, I trust I find you in adequate health."
"And you likewise, Nutt," said Lady Margolotta.
Nutt turned to Glenda.
"What was that term you used once?"
"In the pink," said Glenda.
"Yes, that's right. I'm deeply in the pink," said Nutt.
"And it's Mr. Nutt, if you please, your ladyship."
"Would the two of you care to join us upstairs for a late supper?" asked Vetinari, watching them both very carefully.
"No, I don't think we will impose, but thank you very much. I have a lot to do. Lady Margolotta?"
"Yes."
"Would you come here, please?"
Glenda watched the expressions. Vetinari's faint smile, her look of affront, Nutt's confidence. The rustle of her long black dress was an audible intoxication as she walked the last few steps towards the Ork and stopped.
"Do I have worth?" asked Nutt.
"Yes, Nutt, you do."
"Thank you," said Nutt. "But I am learning that worth is something that must be continuously accumulated. You asked me to be becoming. Have I become?"
"Yes, Nutt, you have become."
"And what is it you want me to do now?"
"Find the orcs that still live in Far Ubervald and bring them back out of the dark."
"Then there are more orcs, like me," said Nutt.
"A few dozen, perhaps," said Margolotta. "But in truth, I could hardly say they are like you. They are a sorry bunch."
"Is it they who should be sorry?" said Nutt.
Glenda watched the faces. Amazingly, Lady Margolotta looked taken aback.
"Many bad things were done under the evil empire," she said. "The best we can do now is undo them. Will you assist in this endeavour?"
"In every way that I can," said Nutt.
"I would like you to teach them civilised behaviour," said Ladyship coldly.
He appeared to consider this.
"Yes, of course. I think that would be quite possible," he said. "And who would you send to teach the humans?"
There was a brief outburst of laughter from Vetinari, who immediately cupped his hand over his mouth.
"Oh, I do beg your pardon," he said.
"But since it falls to me," continued Nutt, "then yes, I shall go into Far Ubervald."
"Pastor Oates will be very pleased to see you, I am sure," said Margolotta.
"He's still alive?" said Nutt.
"Oh, yes, indeed. He is still quite young, after all, and walks with forgiveness at his side. I think he would feel it very appropriate if you were to join him. In fact, he has told me on one of his all too infrequent visits that he would be honoured to pass the rite of forgiveness on to you."
"Nutt doesn't need forgiveness," Glenda burst out.
Nutt smiled and patted her hand.
"Ubervald is a wild country for a man to travel in," he said, "even a holy man. Forgiveness is the name of Pastor Oates's double-headed battle-axe. For Mr. Oates, the crusade against evil is not a metaphor. Forgiveness cut through my chains. I will gladly carry it."
"The kings of the trolls and the dwarfs will give you all the help that they can," said Ladyship.
Nutt nodded. "But first, I have a small favour to ask you, my lord," he said to Vetinari.
"By all means, ask."
"I know the city has a number of golem horses. I wonder if I could borrow one of them."
"Be my guest," said the patrician.
Nut turned to Glenda. "Miss Sugarbean, Juliet told me that you secretly want to ride through Quirm on a warm summer's evening, feeling the wind in your hair. We could leave now. I have saved money." All kinds of reasons why she shouldn't foamed in Glenda's head. Everywhere were responsibilities, commitments, and the never-ending clamour of wanting. There were 1,001 reasons why she should say no. "Yes," she said. "In that case, then, we will not take up any more of your valuable time, my lord, my lady, and will head off to the stables." "But," Lady Margarlotta began. "I think all that needs to be said has been," said Nut. We will, of course, visit you shortly when I have settled my affairs here, and I look forward very much to doing so." He nodded to them, and, with Glenda walking on air beside him, went back the way they had come. "Wasn't that nice?" said Vetinari. "Did you see that they held hands all the time?" At the doorway, Nut turned round. "Oh, just one more thing. Thank you for not posting archers up in the gallery. That would have been so embarrassing."
"I shall drink to your success, Margarlotta," said Vetinari as their footsteps died away. "You know, I seriously intended to proposition Miss Sugarbean to be my cook." He sighed again. "Still, what is a pie to a happy ending?" "You think it's all over?"
The following morning, Ponder Stibbons was at work in the high-energy magic building when Ridcully limped in. There was a glowing silver band around his knee.
"Grapeshot's therapeutic squeezer," he announced. "A simple little spell. I'll be right as rain in no time. Mrs. Whitlow wanted me to put a stocking on it, but I told her I'm not interested in that sort of thing."
"I'm glad to see that you're in such good spirits, Arch-Chancellor," said Ponder, working his way down a long calculation.
"Have you had a chance to see the papers yet this morning, Mr. Stibbons?"
"No, sir. What with the football business, I'm a little behind with my work."
"It may interest you to know that late last night, a 70-foot-high chicken broke out of what they are pleased to call the Higher Energy Magic Building at Brazenick, and is apparently rampaging through Pseudopolis while being pursued by most of the faculty, who, I assume, would be quite capable of terrorising the city all by themselves. Henry has just had a frantic clax and has had to rush off."
"Oh, that is very disturbing, sir."
"Yes, it is, isn't it?" said Ridcully. "Apparently it's laying eggs very fast."
"Ah, that sounds like a quasi-expansion blit phenomenon, adapting itself to a living organism," said Ponder. He turned the page, his pencil moving neatly across the column of figures.
"The former dean has egg all over his face," said Ridcully.
"Well, I'm sure that Professor Turnipseed will be able to bring things back under control," said Ponder. The tone of his voice was entirely unchanged. There was a busy little silence, and Ridcully said,
"How long do you think we should give him to get it under control?"
"What size are the eggs?"
8 or 9 feet high, apparently," said Ridcully.
"With calcium shells?"
"Yes, quite thick, so I'm told."
Ponder looked thoughtfully at the ceiling.
"That's not too bad, then. If you'd said steel, it would have been rather worrying. It sounds very much like a blit devolution, possibly caused by lack of experience."
"I thought you taught Mr. Turnipseed everything you know," said Ridcully, looking happier than Ponder had seen him in a very long time.
"Well, sir, perhaps there was something he didn't quite grasp. Are people at risk?"
"The wizards have told everyone to stay indoors."
"Well, sir, I think if I got some of my equipment together, we could leave about tea time."
"I'll come too, of course," said Ridcully. He looked at Ponder. "And..."
"What?" said Ponder. He looked at Ridcully's grin. "Yes, it might be a good idea if one of the gentlemen from the Times came along to take pictures. They might be very good for instructional purposes."
"An extremely good plan, Mr. Stibbons, and I think we should take the senior faculty as well. They will lend some much-needed..." He snapped his fingers. "What's the word?"
"Confusion," said Ponder.
No, not that," said Ridcully.
"Appetite," said Ponder. "Weight?"
"Something like that. Ah, gravitas. Oh, yes, lots of gravitas. We aren't the kind of fellows who run around chasing strange birds. I'll see you after lunch. And now I have other matters to deal with."
"Yes, Arch-Chancellor," said Ponder. "Oh, and, what about the proposed football match?"
"Regrettably, it appears that it'll have to wait until they have rebuilt the university."
"That's a shame, Arch-Chancellor," said Ponder. He carried on with the calculation until the very last figures danced into place, made sure the Arch-Chancellor had left,
gave a very small smile, which you might not have noticed had you not expected it, and then pulled another ledger towards him.